Welcome to the Reaction Podcast with me, Ian Martin. I'm the editor of Reaction. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want my weekly newsletter and all the brilliant journalism from the Reaction team, the details are below. But on the Reaction Podcast this week, of course, there's only one subject. We're talking about the Ukraine war. It's now in week three. It's 2 weeks since Russia invaded Ukraine. At the time we're recording this, a lot is changing, moving very fast. But firstly, I'm joined by Maggie Pagano and Alistair Benn. Maggie, what have you learned in the last couple of weeks? How has the war so far reshaped our thinking?
Okay, there are two issues that have struck me as surprising, Ian. One is we've seen over the last few months, in fact, these sort of 190,000 Russian troops gathered round the border of Ukraine. And over the last 10 days now, the column of 40 tanks supposedly approaching Kiev, but they haven't actually, you know, and so it looked like ready any moment for any attack. And what's astonishing is, to my mind anyway, that the Ukrainians seem to have held back that column advancing on Kiev. And they've done it because of a sort of frailty, if you like, a weakness. And it's about supplies and logistics. You know, they've talked a lot about no-fly zone and air. They want, fighter jets to be able to take out the Russian military. But in fact, they seem to have done it very effectively by cutting their supplies, both fuel and food, which supposedly is the reason that they've not been able to advance.
Yeah.
So that's quite surprising when you consider the might of the Russian supposedly military. You would have thought they'd have thought of these things, but it doesn't appear that they have. And the second point is the extraordinary speed with which Western leaders have united, both US, UK and the EU, to wreck economic ruin, or to attempt to wreck economic ruin on Moscow, and the speed with which, you know, companies from McDonald's to IKEA to Fendi to, you know, British accountancy firms, they've just stopped trading, or certainly put in train to stop trading, quite apart from the sanctions on the central bank. You know, the actual corporate response to this has been astonishing to witness, really.
It's geo-economic, geopolitical warfare, isn't it? And I've been taken aback by the speed at which that has happened. I mean, you mentioned there the 40-kilometer long, supply line in the run-up to Kiev. That seems now, I think, overnight to have dispersed, and they're attempting to encircle the Ukrainian capital. So we'll see how that unfolds. I suppose the thing, I've been surprised by many aspects of this war, but there was an assumption which was there in the briefings which were given by the UK and the US government, which was based on their intelligence, which turned out to be very good, actually, in terms of anticipating that there was an invasion coming, and it wasn't believed by a lot of people when it was right. But they do also seem to have overstated the Russian strength. Now, maybe that's because the Russians seem to put on very convincing looking exercises last year, and their single biggest exercise to date in 2021, and they've spent a lot of money and made a lot of claims and seem to be advancing, but actually still really, in terms of their basic strategy, tactics, logistics, they don't really seem to have been ready for a war. And then also this question of morale and motivation, which you can spend a ton more money on armed forces as the Russians have done, and hold exercises for the benefit of international TV audiences and domestic nationalistic TV audiences. But still, if when you cross the border without a proper plan, it still really matters what soldiers are fighting for, and they're being asked. And this doesn't quite seem to have occurred to Putin, or his assumption is Ukraine is Russia and part of Russia. But actually, in that case, then, well, ordinary Russian soldiers are going to fairly quickly run up against the horrible reality that they're fighting people who are kith and kin, and that has a morale impact, to say nothing of just the stunning successes that the Ukrainians have had. I shouldn't overdo it because it's still the early days of this conflict, but the successes that they've had in terms of the Ukrainian special forces, the reserves, the kind of operations that they're running, the way in which the Russian cyber capability and communications capability has been extensively disrupted. All of that is just a reminder that the Ukrainians are fighting on their own soil, convinced that they're saving their homeland and that it's an existential battle. And Russian soldiers are being asked to fight for, well, to fight people who are, by Putin's definition, Russian. So the whole thing doesn't quite add up. Alistair, what's interested you most about the last few weeks?
What's really struck me is that even in a war where we're seeing so much footage, I mean, there's if you want to find it's out there, whether it's through sort of open source intelligence sites or on just on Twitter or on other social media. I still think there is a you're really seeing what Clausewitz, well, what Clausewitz didn't say, but what people attribute to him is the fog of war. I got the quotes: three quarters of the factors in which action in war is based are wrapped in a fog of greater or lesser uncertainty. And I actually think there is a high degree of uncertainty still about what is going on in broad swathes of Ukraine, just in terms of where the kind of conventional fighting forces are and how it's unfolding. And and there are so many, it's just it really takes a kind of, I agree with this the what you just said, but even within that, it's so hard to, I think that's really hedged and just a tentative look at like what's going on. And I think that's,
But it's been this this
It's
this
just, I think it's just it takes real judgment, I think, and it takes all that kind of, that kind of specialized knowledge, I think. And you're seeing great analysis come out throughout, certainly from in the UK, and people identifying stuff. And I just think I find that side of it quite fascinating.
Yes, so it's not just a social media war in terms of there are horrific things on social media, but in terms of interpreting and understanding what's going on in the battlefield, it is fascinating to watch academics and defense professionals use social media to broaden understanding. I mean, there's a lot of focus on things like TikTok or social media aimed at younger consumers, where there are really obvious concerns about lots of the footage being fake or being amplified or with different sound effects attached and all the rest of it. But if you follow some of the main best accounts on this stuff, academics and experts, you get an exceptional insight into it. I think it will also reshape some of the debate in the West and in the UK about what a modern armed forces are. And in this sense, I think the MOD in the UK gets criticised a lot for being, off the pace, slimming down the size of the army, even though the defence spending is going up and was going up even before the crisis. But the argument made by the MOD that actually you need more of an emphasis on cyber warfare is being vindicated. So when people say, well, look, you need far more tanks, yes, of course you probably do need far more tanks in terms of the defense of Western Europe, Western and Eastern Europe rather, that is going to have to be constructed in the next 5 to 10 years. But look at how the Ukrainians are doing it. It's a militarized population with large reserve, very active special forces, deployment of drones, and weapons. Look at that weaponry, which comes from the Swedish designers at Saab, and then manufactured in the UK, which has been distributed to the Ukrainians, which has been very effective against old-fashioned Russian crap logistics and Russian tanks. So I think you'll see the beginnings of a oh, this will reshape the de debate on how do how do you defend and hold territory. On the politics of it, Maggie, I was just going to ask you, in the last 2 weeks, have we seen a different side to Boris Johnson? Without getting into the sort of crude, conventional UK politics, does it save him? Does it rescue him? But what's the impact been?
Well, the impact for him in the Ukraine or in Ukraine has obviously been tremendous, and he came second in that poll carried out in Ukraine because he's obviously been one of the most outspoken. At the same time, he's visited Estonia, Poland, so his profile in those countries has risen, and by the same token, it's risen here. Yeah, I do think he might have been saved, and in some ways. He's sort of it's the role that I guess King world king he feels he was made for. I'm reading quite a bit about Churchill at the moment, and you know that it's striking how loathed Churchill was by the Conservative Party even after he'd been made Prime Minister. There's so many striking parallels to his position. I think that he's done some very good things on the economic front. He pushed the hardest for the SWIFT exclusion of the Russian banks from SWIFT system. He went along with the central bank. I think it's very unfair to criticize the slowness with which they've taken sanctions against the oligarchs because it's very complex and you
Are
have to
you
do it.
sure?
Yes, I am
I
sure.
just wonder why they've not had
I think it's
this
very,
in place.
very tricky, Ian, and I've been trying to read up as much as I can. Something like 40% of all sanctions against oligarchs in the past end in failure. They have access to money even if you freeze it. They get very smart lawyers, as we've seen before after Crimea, with some of them in America. So I think you have to get it bang to rights, and we have to remember that. These businessmen, oligarchs, were welcomed with open arms going back 20 years ago, certainly under Tony Blair's government, and they had access to the best lawyers, the best accountants, so they've tied it up. And we allowed them to do this, even though we knew that their source of their revenue was suspicious. And we allowed that in. So they've covered themselves. So I think by the same token, we had to be very careful. And there's been a lot of criticism that we've only done seven. And the EU has done 160. But as somebody said, if you divide that by 26 countries, it's about six each anyway. So, you know, I think and
I
something like
think the
Chelsea is so integral also to British society. You had to get it right. You can't just go around slapping sanctions willy-nilly without making sure of your legal ground. That's my view. But going back to Boris, can I add one more thing? Now he's in a better, stronger position. I think he needs to be a bit ruthless, and he needs to get rid of a couple of his cabinet ministers who have not been working particularly well, like the Home Secretary. He doesn't like being unloved, does he? But now that he's got this, if you like, wind behind him, I think he ought to, you know, improve the quality of the cabinet.
I take the point on the sanctions question, though. It is amusing in a kind of darkly amusing way to say that a lot of top London lawyers who have represented or big big firms that have represented Russian interests are now, I mean, it's all sort of quietly being disappeared from websites and all the rest of it. So it's they're going to they are going to struggle actually to get access to decent legal advice and representation, but we'll see. On the Johnson point, and like you, Maggie, I've been thinking quite a bit about this and dipping back into last night into Andrew Roberts' fantastic Churchill single volume biography, which of course we covered a lot on reaction at the time, and there are parallels, but this is what really concerns me. I mean, it's the early days of this conflict, something that's good, I think, going to reshape Europe and the map of European security and how we think about these things. But the thing I took away from rereading Roberts is just the level of attention to detail and administrative capacity and mental firepower that Churchill had. And even then, he got a lot of stuff wrong. Half the plans he came up with, or for military innovations or operations, would drive Allenbrooke, who's the key military figure in the war, and had decided in terms of planning grand strategy, he would suggest ideas that would drive Allenbrooke to despair. So not everything that Churchill said or produced in this torrent of hard work and running committees and planning produced stuff that was for the good, but still, it just reminded me that in a crisis like this that then lasts for more than 2 weeks, the key thing a prime minister does is to utilize convening power as well as talking directly to the public, which is and explaining what's at stake, which Boris Johnson has a gift for words. I'm not denying it, and he's spoken very clearly throughout this. But it's the way in which a Thatcher or a Brown during the financial crisis with Alistair Darling at his side, even though Brown had been rightly criticised for his policies contributing to Britain being poorly, particularly badly exposed in the financial crisis, Brown and Darling did organise in a very disciplined, technocratic, efficient way, a set of policies which, whether people like them or not, worked. And so I keep thinking when I see, for example, that Britain still in week three of this hasn't properly recalibrated its energy policy for a completely altered era, I think of how Margaret Thatcher would have approached that, or Brown, as I say, or Cameron, or Tony Blair, or maybe Blair's a bad example, but to use that prime ministerial convening power to get the right people around the table and to then ask the best, which are very often the best questions are stupid questions, but the straightforward questions, what's the worst that could happen here? What is the resilience plan? What's the flow of information? How can the best decisions be made? And it should produce a quickening of the pulse among officials and other leading figures and other leading figures in the government. And so I simply pose the question, is what I've described, is that Boris Johnson? How do you think he's doing, Alistair?
I think this whole operation is being coordinated quite successfully, but I'm not sure that's necessarily down to Boris. I think it's because, well, I think it's because of some of the appointments he's made potentially. People like, John Bew at Number 10, who wrote the Integrated Defence Review, seems to be involved. That's from reading Tim Shipman's piece a few weeks ago on the way the kind of foreign policy effort was being coordinated. It seemed to be quite capable, and it seems to have been delegated quite well. I think where Boris needs to be careful, and where the people at the top of the British government needs to be careful, is getting the diplomatic game, a game which is now in full process in, we saw in Turkey yesterday, and with various people engaged in, what was called shuttle diplomacy, going between capitals. I worry a little bit that the kind of robust language that Boris has used, Putin must fail, for example, is not quite serious enough when you're confronted with a country that views the situation of Ukraine as an existential threat and as Western alignment for Ukraine as a kind of absolute no-no. And I just think there is a little bit of a diffidence maybe in the way Boris and our Foreign Secretary Liz Truss have sometimes used language, which is very, very important right now. A contrast, I think, in general, is Ben Wallace's Defence Secretary, who I think is just, with a couple of missteps, has actually stuck to a really, really rigorous line and hedged the robust stuff with, you know, with calming stuff as well. And I don't know if that's fair, but it just seems to me slightly as if, you know, it's all very well. This stuff is great for the kind of Westminster bubble consumption in terms of, you know, Boris saying all that stuff. But I just, I'm worried whether it's actually particularly sensible.
Yeah,
I think
you also put your finger on something there, Alistair, but in terms of the diplomacy that, and it's impossible to know because we don't know how the next 2, 3, 4 weeks of the war will go and how, I mean, Russia, it seems to be in the balance. Russia is now sort of backfilling, trying to secure that territory, but it's exposed then in the rear. So we don't know how much success the Ukrainians are going to have. Can they just turn this into a stalemate, or can they actually punch back? And is there some sort of Russian collapse in morale? So there's a range of potential military outcomes which will shape the diplomatic effort. The diplomatic effort as of now, which is very much Turkey's at the heart of it. Macron is helping to drive it. The US is thinking about what it wants out of peace talks. But that is predicated on some kind of carve-up of Ukraine, which I think the British and the Ukrainians are reluctant to consider. Now, if the war turns into a stalemate, the Macron-Turkish, let's sort of split the difference approach, which I think horrifies the Brits and is seen as rewarding Putin's aggression. If it is a stalemate, maybe that vindicates the effort at a peace talks and some sort of carve-up settlement. But if the Ukrainians carry on doing what they're doing and carry on resisting, it becomes more and more humanitarian damage is inflicted and death and destruction continues. The Ukrainians will dig in naturally. I mean, they will say, look, we're not being defeated. He's losing. Why on earth should substantial concessions be made? So I don't have the definitive answer. I just think it depends on how the progress of the war develops in the next few weeks. Alistair, you've been reading a lot on Moscow, Russia, in an attempt to try and understand what you think is going on in Moscow around those who are Russian nationalists / patriots, but skeptical of the invasion.
Yeah, I think partly because I was slightly, I find the interpretation, which is which has been doing the rounds, it's just that what has happened here is that Putin has, quote unquote, sort of gone mad and invaded Ukraine because he's taking this enormous risk. He's a gambler. And then people say, well, Putin's always been a gambler, as a kind of behavioral psychology interpretation of what's happened. I think you see that a lot in the kind of Western media. And I find that sort of slightly dissatisfying, because the behavioral psychology point, that doesn't stand up to me. What we have to think about is, why does Putin, who everyone, Kremlin watchers in Moscow and serious analysts of Putin and people who work with him for decades, whether it's Andrei Kozyrev, who was the Russian foreign minister in the 90s, why do all those people who say that Putin is not a gambler all get it wrong? And suddenly he's this gambler who's always been gambling and taking risks. For me, that just doesn't... I actually think what that shows is that Putin is slightly more constrained by the past and history and the politics than that. And actually his conduct he's actually from a Russian, from that kind of Russian nationalist point of view, less risky and less of a gamble. So that's one thing. I've been trying to construct, looking at kind of the way Russian think tanks based in Moscow, foreign policy think tanks, try and rationalize the invasion, and then thinking a little bit about how the people around Putin, including Sergei Lavrov, think. Or, there is, it's a sine qua non for them that Russia is a great power, and it's a great power for reasons which are rational, which are that it has a unique geographical position in the world. It borders various parts of the world which are of extreme importance. They all recognize that there is an instability there, that it's got very porous borders and is vulnerable from, particularly from invasion from the West. But there is no doubt in their mind that Russia is geopolitic, is always, whatever the West does, is going to be geopolitically incredibly significant and play a leading role in security affairs, in all kinds of domains. So that's just, for them, that's just what they think. What they will often do in an attempt to rationalize Ukraine is say, what happened in 91 and afterwards was, Gorbachev, people around him, sensible Russians, all thought that they would be invited into a kind of what Gorbachev called a common European home, in which there would be a new security arrangement with Russia treated as a leading partner. What happened is, was not that, they argue, which is America basically said, well, Russia, you can be dependent economically and can be part of some institutions, but you're never going to have a leading role and you're not going to set the rules which govern them. So Russia, you can have that kind of middling power, regional player role, while the West effectively takes on, rolls out its power through sort of geopolitics, democratization, all that. And then what people in Russia then think happened, which is not entirely unfair, is that various things became confused. Humanitarian issues became confused, power issues, democratization actually became a kind of expression of Western dominance, US-led dominance. Whereas we in the West see, for example, the various humanitarian interventions that happened in the 90s and afterwards as actually often quite isolated things or things that happened for rational reasons. The Russians say it's all connected. Started in Yugoslavia, where they removed Milosevic, who was a Russian ally. Then it went on, they overreached. They went on to Iraq, which wasn't NATO-led, but it was Western-led, and they invented this pretext, which was WMD, in order to justify it. And then it happened, well, before that in Afghanistan, and then on and on and on, Libya, all that. NATO is no longer a defensive alliance, it's offensive. They invoked Article 5 to go into Afghanistan. It's clearly not, that's a pretty broad stretching of what Article 5 is. So what they then think is, well, Russia's a great power too. It's finally got its sort of stuff together. It has a right to dominate its near abroad. They see West involvement in Russia's kind of sphere of influence as just a total, that's the final straw in this kind of long story of the West overreaching itself. And now Russia is going to do this stuff too. So when Lavrov says stuff like, we are doing a peacekeeping mission, or we are going in to stop biological weapons, it is actually a kind of joke designed for the domestic audience, which says the West did this in Iraq, so we can do it too, ha ha. So it's a kind of sick joke. It's not meant seriously, and that's I may be wrong about that, but it is a kind of very boring joke about what the West has perceived to have done. And there is some truth in the story, but a lot of it is untrue, given that a lot of these countries in Eastern Europe genuinely did want a different relationship to Russia than they had historically, and have pursued, become part of the Western order, whether it's Estonia or Lithuania, because they wanted to. The problem is Ukraine is a kind of crucible for these problems, and Ukraine has looks both ways since the end of the Cold War, and enjoyed in the 90s Russian gas at massively subsidized rates. The Russians felt that they were being ripped off by the Ukrainians and they weren't being friendly enough. And then the relationship has soured and soured and soured and soured, and we've got to the state where we are at. But that's a very long-winded explanation. But I just find it's a better one, I think, than saying what's happened is Putin is just throwing the dice. There's actually a whole kind of narrative around that that means invading Ukraine is not actually seen as risky from their view as we see it, in the same way as we might not have thought of Iraq as risky as it actually proved out to be, which it was. It was this terrible gamble of history which resulted in untold mayhem throughout the Middle East. But at the time, there were plenty of rational reasons that people constructed around the invasion of Iraq to make it seem like it was
Fair enough. I mean, he didn't I suppose he in that reading, and you know, I have a different I think it's fascinating to try and understand, you know, how the Russians think about these things. I'm skeptical about taking Russian self-mythology too seriously. And also, I mean, just in terms of the early 90s, thinking back to that period and global politics in that period, I get the criticism of the West, and it said more and more often now, you know, why wasn't Russia brought in and made part of this collective security arrangement? But hold on, you know, after the wall comes down, and there is just this outpouring from countries like Poland or in the Baltics who take their freedom, or in Hungary, and the dominant, you know, this is the motif of the early 1990s, is these people finding their freedom again, tales emerging about what really went on in East Germany. So understandably, the West wanted to welcome those people into the Western family behind, you know, call me crazy, good old-fashioned things like liberal democracy, stable institutions, and all the rest of it. Simultaneously, what was Russia's response? And there's a brilliant piece by Zubok on Engelsberg Ideas, Alistair, which you've edited and put out in the last couple of days or so. And of course, Zubok wrote the great recent book called Collapse, essentially how the Soviet Union disintegrated and probably shouldn't have done. He describes it as a monster, but essentially blames Gorbachev for the way in which the collapse happened, and a lot of the problems since then originate, he thinks, in the failed politics of the late 80s and early 90s, and Gorbachev's hubris. But I think the West's attitude has to be understood in the context of the coup. Well, firstly, the coup against Gorbachev, and the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And just it's obvious to the West that the Russians did not have, if they had the capacity for forming free, robust institutions, it was going to be a long way off. The Russian military had already attempted a coup, narrowly averted. I know it was all a bit of a shambles. This is not a country that you could say, look, it wasn't going to admit that it was wrong in the Cold War, because it didn't think that it was wrong in the Cold War. It wasn't going to seek some kind of reconciliation. There was no reconciliation moment like there would be with Germany after 1945. The Russians were too proud to do that, and their politics were so chaotic. And then they follow all this up with Yeltsin, who's inherently become year on year becomes less and less reliable, dysfunctional. Russia is disintegrating. It's being looted by, you know, oligarchs and various other people. So that is not so. I can see now, with the benefit of hindsight, people say, "Well, why wasn't NATO scrapped and replaced with something else?" Well, the West would have been mad to do that. Do you see what I mean, Alistair?
Of course I do, and you know there are lots of that's how history went. But I'm just saying that this is what these kind of people they think. In spite of all that, Russia is a it's just a it just is a great power. It's in its nature to be a power, and this is what great and there's an element of this is what great powers do. The problem with Ukraine is that many of other things about Russian identity and history come together around Ukraine. So the situation of Sevastopol, Crimea, the Donbass, in Russian sort of call it self-mythology, call it, you know, views of identity and culture, you know, it's not just the Slavophiles who think that Crimea is sort of central in some ways to the Russian world. It's even in some degree Westernizers and the kind of the people who believe in Russia as a power, and you know, there's a kind of broad, even liberal people who are perceived as liberal Russians in the West, of which Yeltsin was once one. You know, even Yeltsin would never have said, was pretty hard line on things like Crimea. Alexei Navalny, who is, you know, viewed as a kind of liberal in the West, is, you know, it says let's have another referendum on Crimea, but you know, is clearly, you know, was comfortable with the annexation of Crimea and comfortable with Crimea as part of Russia. So
yeah,
you know, when the West did not accept, for example, the annexation of Crimea, that was another thing, another grievance, if you like, I think, that, you know, is part of that kind of Russian view, which is like, well, if they're not going to accept that, they're never going to accept anything, so we might as well risk. That's what I'm trying to explain.
Yes, no, understand it, but it's a country and a culture that it seems impossible to have any kind of meeting halfway, because the experience since 1917, or since, you know, Russia's disastrous performance in the First World War and then everything that flows from that, is, you know, not anti-Russian. I think what's happening at the moment in terms of banning and prohibiting Russian culture in the West is completely crazed and will backfire, and is just wrong on its own terms. That's not what I'm saying. But so if you think of German historical experience from the 1870s onwards through 14 to 18, and then in 45, there is in West Germany and in East Germany in a different way a proper historical reckoning with the reality that Germany and its ambitions and the fusion of German nationalism with military brilliance and Prussian militarism had wrought extraordinary harm, damage, responsible for the deaths of tens of millions of people, and that Germany, a great culture, a great country, had to rethink its relationship with the rest of the world. And that was a really painful reckoning. And the Germans went through it in the most admirable way possible. That's not feasible with Russia ever, because even a moderate Russian would say, well, Russia's essentially kind of hard done by. The story is of tragedy, of being menaced by the outside world and having to protect itself, and no one loves Russia sufficiently or understands it, this great country, Mother Russia. It's not, ultimately, the rest of us in Europe, it's not our fault that they messed up their end of the First World War, opted for the worst, well, it shares the honour along with Nazism, the worst ideology ever invented by mankind, and then attempted to inflict it on large parts of the rest of the globe, and then did a pact with Hitler, which went spectacularly wrong from a Polish and a Ukrainian perspective and the perspective of tens of millions of other people.
I get it, but that doesn't explain why Russian Democrats still also believe these things. You know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag archipelago.
Sure,
but you know, it was on record several times late in his life on these issues, which would appall Western observers.
Of course,
but made sense to him, and he was what we would call a Democrat. So I think it's.
But what I'm describing, which then, of course, then runs into the Cold War and then the shambles of the early 90s. And then they land on the rest of us. They land Putin, you know, great, thanks. The culmination of 125 years of disaster is Vladimir Putin invading Ukraine. That surely shapes our response, how we think about whether there's a peace deal or some sort of settlement or some rethink about European collective security. We can't be naive in the way that we were in the 1990s, that just automatically, Fukuyama style, liberalism will sort of flow through this kind of balm through Russian society, institutions as they're established will obviously become free institutions, robust, the rule of law, capitalism. Okay, it'll be a bit, bit crazy at first, a bit of a wild west or a wild east on the American 19th century model, but eventually it'll calm down and you'll end up with a stable state that we can trade with. That's not possible, which I think is going to lead to Europe not quite fencing itself off, but culturally and in business and in economic terms, realizing that I'm not suggesting it should be adversarial towards Russia. NATO is, in European terms, a defensive alliance, but essentially you have to put some kind of cultural, business, and military wall up again until this thing, this country, this culture can sort itself out in some way. But maybe even the sanctions and that Maggie described, they probably won't make any difference in reshaping the way that Russia thinks about itself, because again, it'll be someone else's fault. Can I just quickly, Maggie, just on the economic side of things, what do you think the impact is in the UK of all of this? Because we've seen the growth figures are out actually pretty good for the start of the year in the UK, but that's pre-invasion. What do you think's coming?
Do you mean the impact of the sanctions on Russia on the UK economy?
Just the disruption to
The whole
global
thing,
trading
okay.
systems, the whole thing.
It's actually the sanctions are very, very tiny. I think it's 28% of the Russian economy is exports and about 20% imports. So it's very, very small. Trade between Russia and Britain is about 15 billion. So we're not talking huge quantities. It is, of course, the much wider issues, which we already had post-COVID, with the supply chains. So it's not just energy and gas and oil, but wheat prices, fertilizer, a lot of the minerals that come out of Ukraine and Russia, all of those things. You saw what happened to nickel this week, which went up about 250%. In 2 days, because nickel is used in batteries for electric vehicles, and people are worried about the short supply of that. So it will have its tentacles will be felt throughout. What I think would be dangerous here in the UK is if this government tried to blame the war for the cost of living. That would be disingenuous at best. And don't actually get to grips with tackling, well, there's several things, aren't there? The sort of proposed hike in national insurance, sorting out some sort of energy, let's call it subsidy, and more importantly, strategic energy changes and choices for what Britain does, whether it's speeding up oil and gas licenses, looking again at fracking, looking at hydrogen, boosting solar, all these things so we reduce our dependency. Because our actual total dependency on Russian oil and gas is only about 4%, between 4 and 8%. But of course, you've got other impacts. So diesel for industry, there are lots of other ways it affects. So with any luck, but I just hope they don't hide behind this as an excuse and take some serious action, which is why, going back to what I was trying to say earlier, I hope Boris uses this to actually bring in some really good brains to look at this, particularly on energy.
Alistair, do you think Maggie described the potential economic impact all of this is going to have? Do you think let's focus on Britain for a second. Do you think that voters broadly will be willing to accept this stuff? It's going to be quite expensive, isn't it? There was a cost of living crisis already. That's going to be exacerbated by what's happening in Ukraine. Do you think people will? Because people are very agitated at the moment, aren't they? Morally and concerned about what's happening on the ground. Do you think that interest will fade, or will they see, see these costs as sacrifices that must be made?
Well, I think it depends on how tough it is. I mean, our economies are less dependent on the price of oil than they were in the 70s, simply because oil just is in less stuff that we produce. But the shock is still going to be pretty significant. I think I don't know, maybe in 6 months we'll see, but I think obviously Europe is in a different position, and in Germany, for example, the leading German politicians have said, well, we can't cut Germany off Russian gas just like that, because that will mean poverty and misery for many people who live in Germany. And they're quite right. If you did that tomorrow, that would be an extraordinary thing for especially poor people in and it's hard choices. And I think we do need, there is on the one side a moral imperative to show that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is an absolute disaster, humanitarian disaster, and a moral disaster, and it has to pay for it. But I think we that the blithe call for doing stuff which would effectively, destroy large parts of Western economies is a little bit blithe,
To say
We're in a different position here, but it's just like, this already, the price of crude oil and gas is at levels which are absolutely extraordinary. And we'll test this idea to destruction that you can keep on doing that and get away with not having your own energy security.
To say nothing of those people, Maggie, for example, in the city who've been championing ESG obsessively for the last 10 years, and were before the crisis moving into territory of saying, well, you shouldn't buy, shouldn't invest in nasty
Nasty
defense
old
companies or
world.
weapons stocks or all that sort of stuff. And suddenly, because of horrible images on the TV and the horror on the ground, are transformed into hawks saying something must be done. There must be a no-fly zone, which would obviously be a complete calamity. If you want to try and start a nuclear war, that's the best way to do it. Try and create a situation where a US or a British or a Polish plane hits a Russian plane over Ukraine. You've got the potential for escalation. But it's just interesting to see this shift from
Well,
defense being a bit of an unseemly thing to suddenly people realize they need it. I think it might have a bit of an impact in Scotland longer term, actually, in terms of the
boost to funding.
constitution.
I have to say, what this has done is it reinforced my skepticism about the big banks and fund managers who suddenly dashed to go green, because it was obvious they were doing it just because they could see another chance of making more money and not because it was economically or even politically, strategically sensible. So I'm quite glad. BP and Shell, it said they had distressed assets, huge oil fields became distressed assets. I mean, bonkers.
Yeah, it's a new world, the world in which I think and it's the chief executive of BP who said that BP doesn't get involved in politics. It's business, it's business is the is business, which is completely crazy, because energy is at the center of absolutely everything, and is by its very definition is political. But I think we're going to wrap things up there for this week. It was a really interesting discussion. Thank you very much to Alistair Benn and Maggie Pagano, my colleagues from Reaction. Really interesting, Alistair, as well, on Moscow and the Russian perspective. And you're absolutely right, trying to understand all of that is really important. But you're listening to the Reaction podcast with me, Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, and I mean the main site, and you want my weekly newsletter on politics and Maggie on business and much more, and lots of other great writers, including Tim Marshall on geopolitics every Friday and Bruce Anderson on politics and loads more, then become a subscriber to Reaction. The details are below. Until next time, thank you very much for listening.